all of these things led to a tremendous centralization of power. They also led to a tremendous expansion of corporate welfare. And we finally adopted Hamilton's dream of a bank modeled after the Bank of England with the Fed. And so I thought this is a very important year. It's one of the most disastrous years in American history in terms of economic liberty, as far as that goes. So I thought it would be worth devoting class to it. And I think it fits in perfectly with the theme of our course, because this, I consider the year 1913 to be the year that the final nails were pounded into the coffin of the opposition, of the old Jeffersonian ideals of limited, decentralized government and laissez-faire economics, to a large degree anyway, not perfectly Murray Rothbard laissez-faire economics. But in the United States, up until this point, the Democratic Party was the depository of those people who did believe in these things. Grover Cleveland was probably the last American president who actually was a serious believer in the Jeffersonian system of limited and decentralized government, free trade, free markets, to some extent. He was a politician, so he was a human being, of course, he was not perfect. Every time I say or write something favorable about any politician, I always get deluged with emails pointing out this or that imperfection in his or her life. As though making one comment about one positive thing a politician does means that you endorse everything he did over his entire lifetime. That of course is not true. And so I thought I'd start with talking about the 17th Amendment, something that hardly anybody knows about in the U.S. or anywhere else for that matter. It's been swept under the rug like much of American history. But the original American system of having United States senators was that the senators were appointed by members of the state legislature. And the idea here that was endorsed by all the founders, including Hamilton himself in the Federalist Papers, the idea originally was that if a senator was sent to the nation's capital and he misbehaved, that is, he did things, he voted for things that were against the interests of the people back home in the home state, he could be fired on the spot. There would be no waiting for 6 years for the next election. There would be no opportunity for him to travel the entire country or even foreign countries raising campaign cash from lobbyists to campaign for his re-election. He's out of there. And there was a history of this. I put one of my short articles on the syllabus for tonight. And there was a history of this. Hold on a minute. Somebody says they can't hear. Is the volume on? I see one person, Floyd Lilly, saying cannot read lips. Can Floyd hear me now? Okay, Ethan can hear me. Okay. Sorry about the interruption. I just noticed in the chat. Maybe a couple people came in before we started. Okay, well anyway, there was a history of this of where quite a few senators, in the great debate over the Second Bank of the United States between Andrew Jackson and the Bank of the United States, there were, I believe the number was 6 senators who went to Washington promising to back Andrew Jackson in his opposition to the Bank of the United States, but then when they got to Washington, they switched and they endorsed the censorship of Jackson by the United States Senate. And all six of them, or maybe 7, were all fired in very short order. They all lost their seats in the Senate. And that was the idea. That was the idea behind the original system in America of appointing senators by state legislatures. Now, of course, there's no such thing as perfection on earth. And so you could have had corrupt state legislators. They could have cut side deals with the man they appointed as senator by telling him, you go do your thing in Washington, collect money from whoever, the Chinese, New Yorkers, Californians, and get rich, as long as you cut us in on it. They could have worked out those kind of deals. But as a matter of fact, there is a history of senators going to Washington and violating the trust of the people back home and being fired. And that's how it was supposed to work. And so there was a long crusade, however, on the part of the Hamiltonians. The Federalist Party was the first ones to propose the direct election of senators. The Federalists or the Nationalists never liked the idea of having the people themselves, the voters themselves, have much of a real say in politics. They made speech after speech after speech about the virtues of democracy and the virtues of voting, but I think they understood that elections could be so easily controlled by them that that they were just lying. They were just, this was all a smokescreen. Otherwise, they would have supported things like the appointment of senators to the Senate rather than the direct election of senators. And so the first proposal for direct election was in 1826 by a New Yorker and a Federalist, an old Federalist. And between 1926 and 1913, rather, there were 187 resolutions in the United States Congress to do away with the appointment of United States senators and to have direct elections. And most of them, something like 167 of them, came after the year 1880. This was as a result of the rise of the so-called progressives. And the argument that the progressives made was that the direct election of senators would diminish corruption. Of course, there's always some degree of corruption in politics, politics being what it is. And so the progressives argued that if we had direct election of senators, this would reduce corruption. But of course, history has proven this to be exactly the opposite of the truth, because nowadays, a senator from, say, Florida spends a lot of his or her time raising campaign contributions in New York, California, Chicago, Peking, China, anywhere where there are corporations and wealthy people with money, that's where they go. Because campaigns are very, very expensive things. They spend many millions of dollars on television ads and radio ads and everything else, and paying large campaign staffs. And so they are beholden to all of these interests, all these special interests, and they are not so much beholden to the people back home. The votes can be very easily manipulated with all of those, all of that money. And also, in the United States, the system has been gerrymandered so that members of Congress, including the House and the Senate, have the average re-election rate of incumbents has been in the 90 to 95% in the House of Representatives for most of the past 50 years. In the United States Senate, it's just slightly lower than that. You can Google re-election rate of congressional incumbents and get statistics on this. And you'll see that they are what I just said they were. And so the system has been rigged. Just about everybody is guaranteed re-election because of gerrymandering. And they raise many millions of dollars from every special interest in the world to run their campaigns to make sure the gerrymandering works. In addition to gerrymandering, they don't take any chances. They spend many, many millions to make sure that they, for the most part, get reelected. There are a few every once in a while who don't get reelected, but that's maybe 5 or 10% of the House of Representatives, and maybe 10 to 15% over the past 50 years or so in the United States Senate. And so this has the amount of corruption that came after this is many orders of magnitude worse than it was before the 17th Amendment to the United States Constitution. So the progressives, as usual, had it exactly backwards. And I mentioned this article by Todd Zawicki on the chat before the class. It's a law review article from the Cleveland Law Review. And Zawicki is a law professor, at least the last I checked up on him. He was a law professor at George Mason. And he's a law and economics scholar. So he has a background in economics, and he's a law professor. And he wrote this article that's related to the so-called ratchet effect of governmental crises that Robert Higgs is famous for in his book Crisis and Leviathan. And of course, the thesis of Crisis and Leviathan is that whenever there's a crisis, like a war, for example, government powers of every kind ratchet up, taxing powers, spending powers, borrowing powers, powers to abandon the Constitution, and on and on. And then when the war is over, those governmental powers usually recede, but not all the way back to where they were when the war started, so that there's a permanently larger government, even if it continues on the same growth path that it was on before the war, after the war, it has ratcheted up. And Zawicki makes the case in this article that this was not true until 1913, until the 17th Amendment came in. And as a matter of fact, Higgs' book doesn't really start the analysis of the ratchet effect until World War I. It makes a few comments about the 19th century, but the real analysis of the ratchet effect is the World War I era. And, so, and that is consistent with what Todd Zawicki says about the 17th Amendment, because and he makes the argument that the citizen participation in monitoring members of the Senate made sure that if the governmental powers did ratchet up, they ratcheted all, pretty close to all the way back down after the war was over. One example would be even during the Civil War, the American Civil War, that's where we had the first income tax in 1862, but it was abandoned or abolished in 1872. So it was totally abolished. They didn't make it only 1 or 2% compared to 5%. They abolished it altogether, and it did not come back until 1913. And so that's the Wiki's argument. And so this was a very big deal in the year 1913. The 17th Amendment was passed that led to the direct election of senators, because it greatly expanded the powers of the central government. And it took the final vestige of citizen control and states' rights away from the people. And that was pretty much all that they had left, was the 17th Amendment as a way of interposing themselves in a way that could possibly control some of the activities of the federal government. Secession was gone because of what happened during the American Civil War. The right of nullification was gone because of what happened during the Civil War. The Supreme Court had established itself as the sole arbiter of constitutionality and the sole decision maker with regard to what is and is not the constitutional powers of government. And of course that led to a tremendous centralization of power also. So by the time you get to 1913, the only lever, the only tool the American people had to try, at least in a feeble way, to be the masters rather than the servants of their government, was the recalling of United States senators, and that was finally abolished. This was also the year in which the income tax was adopted, the federal income tax. You know, they said the first income tax was in the Lincoln regime in 1862, and it was a progressive income tax. It had a 3% rate on incomes up to $10,000, and then a 5% rate on income above $10,000. And they also adopted withholding for corporations. It wasn't withholding for citizens, but for corporations. So the first income tax and the first withholding tax was invented during the Lincoln administration. And though it was done away with in 1872, the war ended in 1865, and then 7 years later, the income tax was abolished. And so that's a very rare thing in American history. And so the sort of a similar thing happened. This happened with the 17th Amendment. You know, the 17th Amendment involved an 86-year political crusade to get it adopted. And so the Hamiltonians, or the nationalists of American political life, tried mightily for decades to bring back the income tax. There were dozens or hundreds of proposals over the years. And there was one that was adopted very, very briefly in 1894, but the Supreme Court ruled that it was unconstitutional, because it did not proportion the taxes by population as required by the Constitution. And one way in which the income tax was finally brought into being politically was the recruitment of the farm lobby. The post Civil War era was, as you know, you get in this class, was characterized by protectionism in trade policy. The average tariff rate was risen to the 45% to 50% range on average, and it stayed that way from the mid 1860s until 1913. And high protectionist tariffs disproportionately harmed American farmers, especially the farmers of the Midwest, because as I explained in the last class, it was sort of a double or triple whammy, a double or triple cost on farmers. One, since protectionism or protectionist tariffs caused such things as clothing and shoes and farm tools and farm machinery, which had tariffs imposed on them, to be more expensive, the farmers, like everybody else, paid more for these things. And then two, to the farmers, since all farmers had a big export market, the impoverishment of our trading partners meant that foreigners had less money with which to buy American goods, and mostly they were buying American farm goods. So farmers had to pay more for a lot of things that they bought, manufactured goods, and their income was reduced by the same law, by the same tariff law. And so they correctly perceived that they were being disproportionately harmed all these years, from 1863 until 1913, all those years by the Republican Party policy of high protectionist tariffs. And so a deal was cut. The advocates of the nationalists who wanted an income tax cut a deal with the farmers, and the deal was we will reduce the average tariff rate down back down to the 15% to 20% range from the 45% to 50% range if you, the farmers, organize the political support for an income tax. So we'll substitute an income tax for lower, significantly lower tariff rates. And they did. And so they did reduce the tariff rates back down to those levels, and the farm lobby, which was very, very powerful in most states at the time, was very instrumental. We probably would not have gotten an income tax in the year 1913 had it not been for the farmers. And so what happened was there was almost an immediate bait and switch. We got the first income tax. It's very modest. I have a chart right here that shows what it is. The first tax rate, you had to make $20,000 in the year 1913 to pay 1% income tax, and that's the first bracket. The top rate was 7%, so no one paid more than 7%, and you had to make $500,000 in 1913 pay 7%, to be a 7% bracket. And of course, the price level is about at least 20 times higher now than it was in the year 1913, thanks to the Fed. And so that gives you an idea of how modest the original income tax was. So the farmers went for that, and so we had a very modest, very low income tax rate and a low tariff rate. But by 1922, the Ford-McCumber tariff increased the average tariff rate to the 32-33% range. And then by the time you get to 1929 and 1930, you have the Herbert Hoover signing off on the Smoot-Hawley tariff, which raised the average tariff rate up to almost 60%. 59.1% was the average tariff rate under the famous Smoot-Hawley tariff of 1930. And so that was just 17 years. In 17 years, we ended up with an extraordinarily high tariff rate, and so the farmers were screwed, and an income tax. And also by the time you get to that era, 1930, the top tax rate had changed. The first bracket started out where you had to make $20,000 to pay any income tax. Now you only had to make $4,000 by 1928 to pay income tax, and you paid a slightly higher rate, 1 1/8% instead of 1%. And in originally, the highest tax rate was 7%, and you had to make $500,000. But by 1928, the top rate was 25%, and that kicked in at $100,000. So you only had to make $100,000 to be in the 25% bracket by 1928. So this is a classic political bait and switch scam, where the farmers were promised low tariffs in return for their support for a very modest income tax. But within a very short period of time, 17 years, they ended up with the highest tariff rate ever in American history, and a much higher income tax rate than existed at the beginning. And so the farm lobby was instrumental in getting an income tax, and they should have learned their lesson about trusting politicians, but they didn't. Rather than going into any kind of analysis of income taxation, the effects of income taxation, I did that in my course on the Rothbardian analysis of the state, my other Mises Academy course. On the topic of this class, Hamiltonianism versus Jeffersonianism, if that's a word, I want to quote Frank Chodorow, the one book that I put on the reading list for the income tax, which is one of my favorite old books on the subject. Here's what Frank Chodorow said. I'm going to read one passage from it. He said, "The 16th Amendment, that is the amendment that created the federal income tax, corroded the American concept of natural rights, ultimately reduced the American citizen to a status of subject, so much so that he is not aware of it. It enhanced executive power to the point of reducing Congress to innocuity, and enabled the central government to drive the states, once independent units, into subservience. No kingship in the history of the world ever exercised more power than our presidency, or had more of the people's wealth at its disposal." And just look at how this is Hamilton's vision. You might recall from the first class, at the Constitutional Convention, Hamilton proposed a permanent president or a king. And so the income tax gives the American president more power than any king ever had at the time. And it also establishes tremendous power in the executive branch and neuters Congress. And that was also Hamilton's plan. He wanted a permanent president. It also allows the government to bribe the states so that, you know, whatever inclination the people of the states had remaining to challenge the authority of the central government, they could easily be bribed or extorted into quitting. Yeah, nowadays in the United States, if any governor threatens to oppose some federal program, that governor can usually be frightened away by a threat to withdraw some highway grants to his state, or some EPA grants or something of that sort, and the opposition immediately shuts up. In fact, a lot of governors play the game of loudly opposing a federal grant as a way, or a federal program, as a way of soliciting bribes, where the federal government will use carrots and sticks. It not only threatens to withdraw funds, but it can promise more funds from a different pot. Okay, you know, withdraw your opposition to this policy, and we will see to it that your subsidies for Medicare from the federal government are increased by 20%. That kind of a deal can be made. So the government, with all this money, can use threats and bribes to neuter whatever citizen control might come from the states, as far as that's concerned. A couple more good quotes by Frank Chodorow. And here's one that amplifies the implication of the power to the central government that is created by the existence of an income tax. He said, Mr. Lincoln had great difficulty in enforcing a moderate form of conscription, even in wartime. But now we have peacetime conscription." This is in the 50s, he's writing this. "Mr. Lincoln had difficulty with his draft because he did not have the wherewithal to hire an army of enforcement agents. Thanks to the income tax, our present government is not so handicapped." And so the government has the income to enforce things like the draft, the conscription. And now there's one sentence that Frank Todorov wrote, that the 16th Amendment corroded the American concept of natural rights. What he's referring to there is that the natural rights, one of the natural rights is the right to life, liberty, and property meaning your peacefully and legally acquired income. But with the income tax, the federal government is essentially saying, we lay claim to all income. All income is now socialized, and we will decide how much of your income you are allowed to keep for your own survival by setting the income tax rates. You know, we will set the rates from now on. And so that really is what happens with the income tax. And that, I'm sure, is what Todorov was referring to when he said the 16th Amendment corroded the American concept of natural rights. He even went so far as to say this, I'm quoting Frank Todorov again, the freedoms won by Americans in 1776 were lost in the Revolution of 1913. And he's referring not just to the income tax, but the Fed and the 17th Amendment also. And one final quote to show how the income tax and all of the income, all the money that it raises for the government centralizes power in Washington, D.C. There's one final quote from Todorov. He says, the farmer who receives checks from the U.S. Department of Agriculture for not planting his crops does not realize that his grandfather would have thought the practice immoral. He accepts the taking of gratuities as the regular order of things because government propaganda has got him into that frame of mind. And so it's not just the state government that can be bribed into acquiescence. It's any recipient of governmental largesse. And Todorov uses farmers as just one example of what he's talking about there. Okay, one single example. But of course, anybody who gets government benefits of any kind would fall into that category. So that's Todorov's quote. So that was the second plank of the Revolution of 1913. And of course, the third event was the final adoption of the Fed. So we had an 86-year political crusade to adopt the 17th Amendment. They never gave up on that. And then we had the first income tax in 1862. And we had another half-century-long crusade to bring back the income tax with hundreds of proposals in Congress over those years to adopt some kind of income tax, and we finally got it. And then the story of the adoption of the central bank, of the Fed, goes back even further. It goes back to 1781 with the creation of the first Bank of the United States. That was then defunded after the first 20 years, then was resurrected after the War of 1812, and then was defunded by Andrew Jackson in the early 1840s, and then a giant step in the direction of centralized control of the money supply was made during the Lincoln administration with the National Currency Act and the Legal Tender Acts. But that wasn't quite enough. Now, the Legal Tender Acts and the National Currency Acts, they imposed a special tax on state-chartered banks, but there still were state-chartered banks. So there still was competition from these banks with the national banks, the banks that had a national charter and were ruled like a monopoly by federal government regulators. But they had competition. They had state-chartered banks. And so the complete centralization of banking did not occur in the Lincoln administration. There was a giant leap forward toward centralized control of the banking industry from Washington, D.C., but not totally. That took a while. That took another crusade. And to understand some of the economics of the adoption of the Fed, I think you have to understand that what was going on during the so-called progressive era is what I mentioned in the last class. And the two best books I can think of that explain this are the one by Butler Schaefer called Interstate Trade and the old classic by Gabriel Kalko called The Triumph of Conservatism. And they show how big business in America was behind a lot of the adoption of government regulation because they decided that they wanted to use government regulation to thwart competition. Even if the regulatory authority that was created was created in the name of protecting competition. The big business people who were writing a lot of the legislation that created these things, like the Interstate Commerce Commission, they wanted to use these things all along to thwart competition, to reduce competition or eliminate competition, and establish some degree of monopoly power for themselves with the help of government. And these two books tell the whole story. And this, in the field of economics, this is known as the capture theory of regulation. The late George Stigler, when he won the Nobel Prize in economics in the 1980s, this is one of the things that was cited, his early statistical work on the capture theory of regulation, showing how the electric utility companies in the United States captured the regulators so that after regulation was adopted, utility rates went up, not down. The people were promised that the rates would go down, but they went up instead. And if anybody's interested in reading some of George Stigler's early work for which he was awarded the Nobel Prize, he has a little book of essays called The Citizen and the State by George Stigler, S-T-I-G-L-E-R. It was published probably 30 years ago or more, but it contains some of his like early 1960s econometric articles on the electric power industry, and the regulation of the electric power industry. And so the Fed fits into this. The story of the Interstate Commerce Commission, for example, was created in 1877 to supposedly regulate railroad rates in the public interest. In the public interest. Well, the head of the ICC was a railroad industry president, a railroad company president. And what they did was to outlaw price cutting. They outlawed discounts, price discounts. And so there was a way of propping up prices. And that's how government regulation began at the federal level in America. It was regulation for the regulator. That's the phrase that economists use. And the Fed fits right into that. The Fed is a cartel organization run for the benefit of private banks. You don't need to look at any bizarre conspiracy theories. You don't need to wander around a swamp. You don't need to call the Fed a creature that came from the swamp or anything like this. You don't need to look for a conspiracy among the Rothschilds in Europe or anything like that. This is just plain old, good old-fashioned American mercantilism at its worst. And it fits in with all these other regulatory agencies that were being created at the time, the Food and Drug Act, the Interstate Commerce Commission, the antitrust laws, Clayton Act, the Sherman Act, they all did the same thing. They all provided a regulatory cover for the creation of monopoly by government in cahoots with business. And what could be more Hamiltonian than that? What could be more Hamiltonian than that? Nothing at all. And the whole story is told in great detail by Murray Rothbard in his book, A History of Money and Banking in the United States. And I'm certainly not going to do that here, but if anyone's interested in following up and reading about some of the nitty-gritty details of the who's and whys, who was involved, what motivated them, that's the book I would recommend. And, of course, one of the things that Rothbard does a great job at, and no one else that I know of does, is that he talks about the role of intellectuals here, such as Richard D. Ely, the co-founder of the American Economic Association, who was working for the bankers, the New York bankers primarily, who wanted the Fed and creating publications claiming that a bank run by politicians of the nation's capital will stabilize the economy. And so it was a combination of the private bankers who wanted cartel or monopoly power, but like all cartels, they could never get it in the private sector. It always requires governmental enforcement, and the type of governmental enforcement they got was regulation by the Fed. To get an idea of the long arm of the Fed, you can look up an article of mine on the web. It was on, I think it was lewrockwell.com, although I might have sent it to Mises and Moore years ago. I forget which one. It was called The Myth of the Libertarian Fed. It was a while after the Great Recession hit, and you had all these people claiming that since Alan Greenspan was an associate of Ayn Rand's in the early 1960s. The Fed, under his leadership, was some sort of laissez-faire institution that promoted unregulated free markets. But I just went on the Fed's own website and found a publication called The Structure and Functions of the Federal Reserve System, published by the Fed, and it lists hundreds of regulatory activities that the Fed is engaged in addition to monetary policy, in addition to open market operations or the buying and selling of bonds. It regulates pretty much all aspects of financial markets, as do the controller of the currency, the Office of Thrift Supervision, and the Securities and Exchange Commission, and state and local regulatory authorities, too. So financial markets are extraordinarily heavily regulated, and they have been for a long, long time. And much of this regulation is for the regulated industries, for the benefit of the regulated industries. Every once in a while, it works the other way. But for the most part, that's been the history. And the Fed falls right into that. And so that was the third element of the revolution of 1913. And for the purposes of this course, what these things all did was to create an unthinkable an amount of centralized political power that would have been unthinkable. If it wasn't unthinkable to the founding fathers, they would have thought that it was horrific to do this, because it finally wrested the last vestiges of citizen control away from the citizens by giving the government all that money. And part of my research, I rounded up several books from the university library that I could get on the history of taxation, including the history of the income tax. And one of them, the author very matter-of-factly said that were it not for the Fed, America might not have been able to participate in World War I. And the author was saying that, although that's a good thing that America participated in World War I, but that's exactly the type of thing that the Jeffersonians always warned against, that, one of the things about war is that the financing of war through money creation creates what public choice economists call a fiscal illusion. It reduces the perceived cost of government, not the real cost, but the perceived cost. So if you had a war that the politicians wanted to get involved in, not the people, the politicians, if the politicians have to go to the people and say to each family, we're going to assess a $25,000 a year war tax on you, not only will they not go to war, but they will probably be kicked out of office if they do that. But if they get the Fed to simply turn up the money, the Fed and the Treasury, well, the people won't know about it. The average person has no idea that the war is costing him something in the form of future inflation or the creation of a boom and bust cycle. And if it does create a boom and bust cycle, which it inevitably does, it's blamed on capitalism. It's not blamed on the Fed, because most people are totally ignorant of Fed monetary policy. And that's the way the government wants it. And so when we did adopt the Fed, of course, in 1913, it did finance about a fourth of the World War I, and it did double the price level. The consumer price index in the United States doubled during the war years, as did the amount of money in circulation, the money supply that was in circulation, and it created a bust. There was a boom created, and the bust was the Great Depression of 1920. The Great Depression of 1920 was worse than the Great Depression, the first year of the Great Depression of 1930, of the 1930s. The drop-off in GDP and the increase in unemployment was worse than the drop-off of GDP and the increase in unemployment in the first year of the Great Depression, a decade later. But the government still at that time responded by cutting back spending and taxing, because that was the American system of dealing with recessions up until the 1930s. But then when Hoover, and then Roosevelt reversed that, the initial response of 1920 was to cut back. But by the time we get to 1930 and we're in a depression, massive government intervention was the response. For the first time ever in American history, a depression or a panic was responded to by massive interventionism, first by Hoover, then by Roosevelt, and the result was a Great Depression that lasted for 15 years. It never really ended until World War II was over with. And of course, the Fed and the income tax were instrumental in funding that also. And so one of the legacies of the revolution of 1913 was that not only the strengthening of governmental power in Washington, but the funding of unnecessary wars and unnecessary military interventions through money creation by the Fed. And that, of course, is the type of thing that Hamilton always wanted that, the government to do. He used the words imperial glory. He wanted America to pursue imperial glory of the sort that England did. And he, even in one of his speeches, referred to how the Bank of England had been so instrumental in financing these glorious wars that that England was involved in, nonstop for a couple of centuries, it seems. And so that's where we are now. That's where the Americans are now. And I guess I'll stop about there. I've been talking for about 40 minutes and summarizing my thoughts on the revolution of 1913. And I'll go back to the chat and the Q&A and see if we have some questions. I see Cam is doing his usual great job with the links. See, Jim Dudley has a comment. The Electoral College method, winner take all, and congressional district method. Under the United States Constitution, the states can decide what method they want to use with the Electoral College. And I guess winner take all is one, or you could determine it by congressional districts. I don't really have a comment on that. I haven't really studied this, whether it's different or not, but I think it's generally a good idea to allow the states to decide for themselves what they want to do rather than have the federal government dictate it because of the age-old dictum that governments are easier to control by the people the closer they are to the people, even though the government has been at war with states' rights and federalism for more than 250 years, I think it still is nevertheless true that the closer to the people government is, more likely it is that the people can exert some kind of control over the government. And so I don't have an opinion on these two different types of electoral college arrangements, other than it's a good idea that the states are allowed to experiment with different forms. Let's see if there's anything under the Q&A. So Joel's asking, he says, I refer to a long campaign that eventually led to the 17th Amendment. Well, it was the nationalists in American politics. It began the very first proposal for direct election of senators. Was from an old Federalist who was a New York politician and a nationalist, because they always understood that this would centralize power. This would take power away from the people of the states and put it in the hands of the central government, the people who were influential in Washington. And so it began with an old Federalist in the 1820s, 1822, and then there were various Whigs and Republicans who proposed it. And by the time you get to the 19th century, it was the progressives that really adopted this as their agenda because they figured that they could control Washington, D.C., and the progressives were always super disdainful of states' rights, decentralization, Jefferson, his ideas, his followers. They considered Grover Cleveland to be their mortal political enemy. because he was a Jeffersonian. And so there's a long line of people who did that. If you want to know the details, read the Professor Rossum's book that I put on via chat at the beginning of the class, and which is also up here on the board that Cam has put up. And Helen is asking, how does Bernanke explain the Great Depression? Bernanke, there are several different explanations of the Great Depression. Bernanke is a believer in the Milton Friedman Anna Schwartz interpretation. There's a big book written by Milton Friedman and Anna Schwartz on a history of a monetary history of the United States is the name of the book. And when they get to the Great Depression era, their argument has always been that the Fed responded to the stock market crash of 1929 with a one-third reduction in the money supply between 1929 and 1932. And that, Friedman says, turned a stock market crash into a Great Depression. And then they also criticize or fault the Fed for not expanding the money supply enough to their liking during the 1930s, the Great Depression. Now, the alternative view is the view of the Austrians and of Murray Rothbard in particular. In his book, The Panic of the Great America's Great Depression, is one of Rothbard's books, where he it talks all about the 1920s, and he makes the argument that in keeping with the Austrian theory of the business cycle, it was the monetary expansion by the Fed that took place during the Roaring 20s, during the late 20s, that helped the 20s roar, so to speak, that created a bubble, and the bubble burst, and then the bursting of the bubble was the Great Depression. And then in addition to that, of course, all of this government intervention, the pervasive price controls and the supply restrictions, the acreage allotments in farming, the social security taxes, unemployment taxes, strengthening of labor unions all by law, all these things, all these government interventions also piled on and made and destroyed markets even more than the bubble created by the Fed did. And so those are two opposing views of this. Bernanke is a believer in the Friedman view. And so that's why he's of the opinion that what we need is more money creation, not less, always. Let's see, Cam Ray is asking about the first part of World War I paid for by American bankers lending to Europe. Yeah, probably. I think, yeah, they did borrow money from some American bankers, but I can't give you any details on that. I would even recommend reading Rothbard's books. Assuming Cam means the European, World War I before the Americans got involved in it. 1917, 1918. See if there's anything on the Q&A. Let's see, there's something here from Eric in the Q&A. The first tax rates were set up as progressive. Was there much support for a flat tax rate? I can't say that I know about this. You know, the first income tax in 1913 was progressive. There were different rates. I can't say there was much support for a flat tax rate. Milton Friedman came in his famous book, Capitalism and Freedom, written with his wife Rose in the 1960s. Was one of the first modern advocates of a flat rate income tax. And so, but I don't know that I can't think of any economists that I could think of at this period of history that were advocating a flat tax. Friedman had done it in the 60s. Let's see, Bob is asking how the Fed controlled the state chartered banks Well, I would recommend my article that Ken has put up with a link to on the myth of the libertarian Fed, and also find this publication called The Structure and Functions of the Federal Reserve System, which I found online. It's a Fed publication. I refer to it in my article on the myth of the libertarian Fed, and it gives a big long list of, you know, I made them bullet points, and I didn't even include all the functions of the Fed, of all the things and the ways in which the Fed controls banks of the country. And so that's what I would look for. Let's see, Malcolm is asking, has anyone from the Austrian School prioritized what laws need to be repealed? Well, first of all, you know, Austrian economics itself does not make the case for the repeal or the acceptance of any law or any set of priorities. It's used to analyze the effects. And then Austrian economists can make value judgments and saying, based on my economic analysis of what's going on here with the Fed or the 17th Amendment or any of this, I make the subjective value judgment that we should abolish this. And there's nothing wrong about doing that. Murray Rothbard, one of the reasons I like Murray Rothbard so much and his writing so much is not only was he a great economist and really extraordinarily well-schooled in the history of economic thought and economic theory and a great applied economist, but he also was a natural rights philosopher. And he also said that, you know, he had his theory of libertarianism, and with the point number one being the non-aggression axiom. So he would do his economic analysis, and then he would say, well, for policy purposes, these are my views. My views is that we shouldn't use government to aggressively steal one person's property for no other reason than to buy votes with it by giving it away to another person. So he would be upfront about it. These are my views. These are not based on science. These are my personal views, my philosophical views, and here they are. This is very different than other economists who pretend to be value-free, but who are never are. The economists like Paul Krugman, who pretends to be value-free in his economics writings, never is. They make policy recommendations all the time that have all sorts of deleterious effects, but they pretend. They lie, in other words, about being value-free. Rothbard never did that. And so keep that in mind, that the Austrian economics per se says really nothing about what should be, what we should do, but Austrian economists do. And one of the appealing things of the Austrian economists is that they've always been upfront about it and said, you know, I don't buy into this idea that as an economist I have to pretend that I'm a value-free scientist. I will use science to the best of my ability to understand how the economic world works, but then I'll give you my opinion. You know, should we abolish the Fed or not? And so I would think that if you took a poll, abolishing the Fed would be number one. And the 17th Amendment, I would think abolishing the income tax would be number one or number two. But I personally think the 17th Amendment should be at least number three, no further down, because that would be really strike fear in the hearts of the ruling class if the people could once again get a foot in the door. Let's see, Malcolm is asking, if an amendment has to be passed by three-fourths of the states, how did the 17th Amendment get passed? Well, it was the progressives. The progressives were very influential, and they persuaded three-fourths of the legislatures to go along with direct election of senators. They also, one of the arguments they made, I haven't mentioned this yet, was they said because of this system of appointing senators, sometimes if a senator died, or if he was replaced, if he was recalled, there would be political haggling that would last for a long, long time, and so some states might go without full representation in the United States Senate for a long time. And so their argument was, well, with direct elections, this won't happen, because if the senator dies or is for somehow, yeah, some reason, has to leave office, he gets sick, we just schedule an election a month from now, and we'll have, or 2 months from now, and we'll have an election, and you won't have this. That was the main argument they made. But it turns out, though, that the main reason why there were long periods of time where some states did go without two senators was federal intervention in state election laws. The federal government imposed various rules and regulations that made it difficult to replace senators. And so so they took advantage of that fact and made up this story about how it was the system of appointing senators that was the problem. And it won the day. Let's see, another question, part of this question, why do the states allow for themselves to be tied to 3/4 vote to change the document? Well, the idea was they wanted to make it hard to change the Constitution. And so 3/4 vote is a qualified majority. It's not a simple majority, it's not 51%. So the argument that was made is that we don't want just 51%, we want to make it hard to change the Constitution because of the idea that if it requires a 3/5 or four-fifths vote, the thinking was, well, then what's being changed? The change will probably benefit almost the whole population if we require something close to unanimity to change this thing. And so part of the thinking was also that only the kinds of constitutional amendments would be proposed that the authors of the amendments think or can make the argument that would benefit almost everybody, as opposed to a very narrow special interest being benefited by constitutional amendments. That was their thinking. Is there anything else in the Q&A? Let's see, Eric says, how did the Fed get around back in 1913 to get around to the Constitution's no federal taxation? Well, the Constitution was amended to allow taxation, the original Constitution prohibited the direct taxation of income. In fact, the real original Constitution was the Articles of Confederation, which did not allow for any tax authority at all by the central government. All the taxing authority was in the states. But they gave that away when they adopted the Constitution. But then the Constitution still did not allow for direct taxation. And so that's why the Income Tax Amendment that came in 1913 did change that. It allowed for the direct taxation of income. Malcolm also asked, they also felt as a last resort they could secede. Yes, they did. At the time of the original Constitution, I don't think you could find anybody who did not believe that secession was a part of the natural rights of the people, because America was created by a war of secession from the British Empire. And the first Americans to try to secede were the New England Federalists, who tried to secede after Jefferson was elected president. And they even held their famous Hartford, Connecticut secession convention in the year 1814. And I've read the books about that. I've actually read the documents and speeches that were made at this convention. And it's very difficult to find anybody at the time who said that there was not a legitimate right of secession. The arguments were all over, is this a wise thing to do economically for our region, or politically, is this a wise thing to do? But as far as it being a right, I don't think anybody really challenged it as being a right. And so, they must have had in the backs of their minds nullification and secession, which certainly is still alive. The colonists practiced nullification even before the Revolution. And so that was a part of the American system. else we have here? Okay, Malcolm's also asking about the guy in the news yesterday. He actually had both arms and both legs blown off in Iraq a couple of years ago, and they gave him arm transplant to Johns Hopkins Hospital recently. And he's in the front page of a lot of newspapers. I didn't know we were reducing the cost of war with regard to injuries. Getting stainless steel arms is not really reducing the cost of war in my book. Mostly government is involved in hiding the cost of war, not actually literally reducing the cost of war, but hiding it from the people and disguising it or deferring it to the future. So I'm not sure, Malcolm, that this sort of thing reduces the cost of war at all. Reducing the recovery costs. Well, they're paying for them. I mean, if the taxpayers pay for the recovery costs. The government also wages a propaganda campaign with these sickening pictures of, say, of George W. Bush jogging with a soldier who lost both legs below the knee and who now has fake legs below the knee and who can actually pretend to run. You can find pictures on the web like that. And so they want to make it seem it's a good thing that this is happening. But that's a point. Bob wants to know if anybody has a comment on David Gordon's book on secession. Yes, my article in it is probably the best one. I'm saying that as a joke, of course. And it's a great book. It's a great collection of essays, especially Donald Livingston's essay. Very good. Another question. Well, Malcolm is full of questions here. Let's see. He's asking if Carter has not increased the money, Carter didn't do it, but the Fed during the Carter years. Have slowed down the inflation rate. Well, actually, when Carter appointed Paul Volcker as chairman of the Fed, and Volcker reduced the money supply very significantly in 1979, 1980, and that's how inflation was whipped. Finally, there was 13% price inflation and 10% unemployment in the year 1980, if I can recall correctly, around those numbers. But that was all gone by 1983. And so that's the sort of thing that had to happen. The only way to get rid of the inflation caused by the Fed was to reverse what the Fed had been doing for quite a while in trying to monetize the OPEC oil crisis. And at the time, it was called accommodating monetary policy. The oil embargo ratcheted up the cost of production of a lot of items, a lot of manufactured items, and to try to ameliorate the effects of that on unemployment, the Fed pumped up the money supply. And then it abruptly reversed itself when Paul Volcker came in because it created so much inflation. How much bigger can the military get? Who knows? We've got the militarization of the police going on now, too, the local police, which is totally at odds with the Constitution. And I can't really answer that. I would recommend the book on secession by David Gordon. It's a very good book. And there was a conference that the Mises Institute held some years ago in Charleston, South Carolina. And there are a lot of very good essays, and there's good scholarly essays in that book. It's a good deal, too. It's not too expensive. Bob was enough. I could comment on Rothbard's take on centralization versus local sovereignty. Rothbard, he was a famous libertarian, a famous anarcho-capitalist. But also he was a realist, and he wanted to see a movement in the direction of freedom in his lifetime. And so he often criticized or excoriated the purists, or a lot of libertarian purists who will look at somebody like myself who makes the art, or like Murray Rothbard, who speaks favorably in favor of nullification or secession, or someone like Tom Woods, and will condemn them for saying that, because they'll say, well, what we need is no government, not more decentralized government, not government that's close to people. We want no government. We want heaven on earth. So if the people like this, who I call them the libertarian purists, it's either no government at all or the hell with everything. You're evil. And Murray Rothbard was not like that at all. He did not like these people who were constantly bugging and pestering him with mail and emails about this sort of thing. He was an advocate of states' rights. You can read his article on the web entitled "Just War," where he has harsh criticisms of Abe Lincoln that are very similar to mine in my writings and my books and articles on Lincoln. He once, as a young man, he supported the States' Rights Party when it ran Strom Thurmond for president. I think it was 1948, because their platform was all about decentralization and states' rights. And he thought at the time, Rothbard thought, that the civil rights laws were just sort of a ruse to centralize power even more, and that the people behind them were not really interested in extending civil rights to black people in America. That this was all sort of a gimmick. I think that's what Murray thought about it. So he thought this would be better handled at the state and local level. And so he was not a purist on this, and he would be. He understood, like classical liberals have for hundreds of years, that if the citizens have any chance of controlling government once we have government, it's always more likely to happen the closer government is to the people, local government versus centralized government. And so Rothbard was a realist in that regard. He could be among the best of the theoreticians philosophically. To construct some sort of libertopian or libertarian utopia, but he was a pragmatist also. See, Helen is asking if I think it's okay for county governments to buy land for public use if the majority want it. Well, I don't think it's legitimate to do anything because the majority wants it, because I think democracy is just organized theft. Democracy is like two wolves and a sheep voting on what to have for lunch. And so I think theft is theft. And just because we call it democracy or social justice does not make it theft. And besides that, government is with eminent domain and taking up land, buying land, it rarely does this for public use. It almost always does it for the use of some special interest group who will then help to finance the campaigns of the politicians who stole people's lands on their behalf. The famous Homestead Act in the 1860s, I've already said in this class, there's research that shows that about 87% of all the land went to corporations under the Homestead Act, railroad corporations, mining, forestry corporations, and only a pittance, 13%, went to actual settlers, actual farmers. So whatever the government says it's going to buy land or appropriate land or something for public use, it's rarely, if ever, for use by the general public. It's always special interest, more often than not. Let's see what Q&A. Erica Bravenel is asking, what would it take today for a state to leave the United States? Well, we don't know, but look up Second Vermont Republic, or look up also the Middlebury Institute. The Middlebury Institute in Vermont, founded in Vermont, they've been advocating the secession of a state like Vermont for a long time now. And they have a secession document made out. It's not a request to the White House. It's a declaration. It pretty much says, we're leaving, good luck, we're out of here. And they have a separate copies prepared for the President, Congress, and the Supreme Court. And so, but that's something to be worked out. I don't have an answer to that question, but if you want to try to educate yourself on it, if I did, I would look into the people who have been literally thinking about how to go about doing this. And so go online and look up Second Vermont Republic and the Middlebury Institute. It's Middlebury, Vermont is what it's named after. Yes, Bob Jones was part of the justification for the Fed to control inflation. Yes, although the price level was at least 20 times higher today than it was when the Fed was created. Malcolm is asking about the Community Reinvestment Act of 1977. I've written about that as much as anybody on the Austrian. In fact, I might be the only Austrian that's written much about this. If you go online and get the session primer on Mises.org, you'll see several of my articles related to the Community Reinvestment Act. And how did it come into being? Well, this is the Carter administration. And the theory behind it was that bankers were discriminating against minorities in lending, discriminating by race. It was called redlining. They weren't making mortgage loans in predominantly minority neighborhoods, was the argument. And so the Community Reinvestment Act was put into place that essentially forces or extorts banks into making loans in these areas where they were not previously making loans, and the government rates the banks. And if you don't have an adequate rating, you can be fined by the government. And that law was strengthened in the mid-90s by the Clinton administration with the help of quite a few Republicans, although there were a lot of Republicans against it, the former senator from Texas, Phil Graham, was the leader of the opposition to the Community Reinvestment Act. It was always a fishy idea, though, because the assumption behind it was that there are perfectly qualified borrowers out there, and the banks could make many millions of dollars in profits if only they would lend to them. But they are so obsessed by racism and hatred of black people that they will not make the loan. By 1977, that is a very fishy scenario, very, very dubious scenario that banks are going to turn their backs on hundreds of millions or billions of dollars in profits. But it's the law. The law was created. And so what it has turned into is an extortion racket. There are all these left-wing nonprofit organizations that have been set up. And the law says that if one of these left-wing nonprofit organizations, many of which got seed money from the government, issues a complaint about a bank that has proposed a merger or a branch expansion, then the Fed can hold up the merger or the bank expansion until the bank gives money, sometimes hundreds of millions of dollars, hundreds of millions, to the community organization. Acorn is the most famous so-called nonprofit group that has been involved in this racket for long years. The Association of Community Organizations for Reform Now, Acorn, started up in the 70s to do just this. So they're basically extortion artists, and they get a lot of the money, and then they go into banking business. They make these loans. So essentially, the Community Reinvestment Act is a tool the government uses to force bankers to make bad loans to unqualified borrowers, and these loans are called subprime loans. That's the euphemism that is given, is subprime loans. And Countrywide Bank was given a special award by the Fed for having made, what's the number, $200 billion of these loans, I believe, and that was about a month before Countrywide Bank went bankrupt altogether. Primarily because of all these subprime loans. And so you can read, Ben Bernanke, it was in 2007 was the anniversary of this, and Ben Bernanke himself made a big speech congratulating everybody involved in the Community Reinvestment Act. And I've written about it in some of my articles on Mises.org and LouRockwell.com. I suppose if you Google my name and Community Reinvestment Act, you'll find these articles. If there's anything else in the Q&A here. Okay. Well, it looks like we're pretty much running out of gas, folks. I guess we'll end it there. It's 6:45, and so we'll call it a day. And thanks again for participating. I hope you all learned something valuable. And I will make up another quiz for any students who would like to grade in the class. And I'll probably do it the next day or two and send it on to Danny. So it'll be available to the class. And so when you get your certificate, you can get a grade 2 if you wish. If not, of course, that's optional. No one has to do that. And thanks for participating again. And thanks again to Kay and Cam, rather, and Danny and everybody involved from the Mises Institute in making this thing run very smoothly once again. And everybody have a good night.